Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Got a question for you. Are you up to your ears in peaches or maybe squash or maybe tomatoes? If you want to preserve the harvest this year, now's a good time to brush up on the basics of canning. And our guest today knows a heck of a lot about preserving your summer harvest. Christina Ward is a certified master food preserver for Milwaukee County who offers preservation classes. She's also the author of the book Preservation, The Art and Science of Canning, Fermentation, and Dehydration. Her latest book is titled Holy Food, How Cults, Communes, and New Religious Movements Influence What We Eat. As we talk with Christina, I hope you'll join in with your questions about canning or maybe fermenting and dehydrating foods. How often do you can or preserve? What's your go-to method? Give us a call. Number is 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. Christina Ward, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Oh, it's so nice to see and speak with everyone. I love getting calls and questions. So I hope folks do have some questions and we'll call in and see if we can help people out and maybe even stump the chump here.
Okay. Well, what are you currently preserving at home?
Well, as you mentioned, the peaches are coming. A lot of friends are lucky enough to have some lovely peach trees. So I am definitely thinking about peaches and, of course, thinking about pickles as we come to the end of some of the cukes and doing some proper Wisconsin style, that kind of kosher. Milwaukee and Wisconsin have a great, almost unique pickle style because we do kind of a half fermented, but half vinegar brine. And it's very unique to us.
Well, and it's good, too. So, yeah, cukes are, I mean, I'm thinking about what's good for canning at this time of the year. Cukes are good. Tomatoes would be good.
Oh, tomatoes are fantastic. Tomatoes are so versatile. To whether you can them whole just and use them as whole tomatoes, sauces, Bloody Mary mix. They can also, people forget sometimes, they're a fruit. You can make tomato jam and that tastes lovely. A little cinnamon and put that on a roast beef sandwich. Oh, that's delicious.
I agree 100%. I love tomato jam. And an old friend of mine made it every year and I absolutely loved it. I used to can 50 quarts of V8 type tomato juice every year. So I had a quart a week, except for 2 weeks of vacation.
So, and Larry, that's something I actually recommend to folks in when they ask me, what should I be canning? How much should I be canning or preserving? And I ask the question back is just like, how much of the thing do you use during the year? So if you do go through a quart of a tomato juice through a year, then you should be putting up 52 quarts at least, and maybe a few extra for parties and friends.
So fruits and vegetables, fruits, you mentioned peaches. Clara Neipert's probably got her ears perked up for this because she's got peaches almost coming out of her ears. Can you can peaches?
I mean, absolutely. Peaches work up beautifully and work up kind of being the old fashioned way to say processing. Peaches, of course, you can go sweet with them. And that opens up the idea of jams and jellies, pie fillings, things like that. You can go sweet and sour and think about that. An apple cider vinegar based with some really warming spices. And you can pickle those peaches. So you get some sweet sour flavor. And I'm not done. You can definitely then work them in with other types of fruits and vegetables and make more of, say, a chutney. Chutneys are great solutions for maybe the bruisers, the ones that aren't like picture perfect, but you don't want to waste them. And chutneys solve a lot of problems that way.
Actually, Elizabeth in Columbia County has a question relating to peaches. Maybe we just answered it. Elizabeth, are you there?
Yeah, I like all of those ideas. And I also wanted to add, Larry will remember this. There was an extension fruit specialist who always had said, you know, a couple decades ago, the one bulletin he'd never have to write is how to care for your mature peach tree. But that has definitely changed over the last, you know, few years, these hardier varieties. I never thought I'd see the day we'd have all these peaches growing in Wisconsin. Anyway, I just literally, as your show came on, I was peeling and slicing local peaches, and I tossed them with lemon juice, and I'm freezing them because I picked them 5 days ago, so I used a few fresh and ate a few in hand, but I just thought that might be a good way to hold them until I figure out my next move.
Yeah.
You are very smart to do that. We recommend it. Because sometimes, too, the fruit doesn't always follow our schedule. And so there you'll get days where you have to pick, and maybe you don't have enough to do a whole batch of whatever you want to make. And so short duration, you're doing it exactly right. Peel the peaches, douse them in a lemon juice. Again, that doesn't affect the flavor of the peaches. That little bit of acidification helps them from turning brown, the oxidization, and just helps keep them a little fresher. Put them in a nice freezer bag, throw them in the freezer until you have enough to do a batch. And just shorthand math is one batch of jam is about four cups. Sometimes you can go up to double that to 8 cups. So that's about a quart to 2 quarts of peaches you'll need for one batch of jam.
Now, that help, Elizabeth?
Yeah, I thought even the frozen slices could be thrown in for a smoothie or something, too, if I am really not feeling ambitious. So,
absolutely, right. That works. You can use those. And also, once they're frozen like that, even if you wanted to just say you cook them down, just for if you want to make like a cobbler or something with peaches in it, you can use those frozen peaches throughout the year.
Elizabeth, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, let's hear from Gwen in Madison. Gwen, hello.
Hello. My question is about false seals and failed seals and canning. Now, I have a pressure canner, and I can a lot of meat because I happen to like it that way. And I had a couple of quarts of meat that were canned with standard lids. And when I take the ring off, you make sure you test the seal. Well, I forgot to take the rings off of two jars, and I was downstairs in the basement checking on my canned jars, and I noticed that. So I brought those two upstairs, and when I took the ring off, the lids came with it. So that was 2 quarts of pure meat, and that was a very expensive loss. And I'm wondering about false seals or, the jars, the lids were dimpled down, and yet when I took those rings off, they still just lifted off with my hands, and that was very concerning. I've been canning for about a decade.
So let me speak to that a little bit. So it's something I always talk about in classes and in my books, is that you can do everything 100% correctly and still have a jar failure. So just know that. But also then to troubleshoot things is hearing that this is a pressure canner, knowing that your pressure canning, it's a tool. It's a fantastic tool. And as the caller is canning meat, it is the preferred tool to use for low acid foods. So foods that are not acidified or are naturally really low pH. But as a machine, the pressure can go out of sync. And so it's something that the state of Wisconsin, that all the extension recommends, is have your pressure canner tested, have the gauge tested, because it's a possibility is that you might be off, the gauge might be off. The gauges can be replaced quite easily, and they're fairly inexpensive compared to the price of a whole canner. So that is something to consider. The other thing to consider is that sometimes is if you don't remove the ring, it exerts a certain amount of pressure that can affect the seal afterwards. So, and that's after long-term storage. So that is a potential fail point too. hopefully you don't give up. It doesn't sound like you're going to, but also know, get that pressure canner gauge checked and always try to follow those proper procedures. And that helps reduce the risk of failure on the lids.
Yeah. And botulism. You want to get rid of those. I'm assuming Gwen got rid of those.
I'm assuming Gwen did too, because if she's been canning for 10 years, she knows. And that's out to anybody. If something looks a little off in the color, or if the lid, as Gwen described, comes off in your hand, that is not a safe product to eat. Please dispose of it, and dispose of it meaning throw it in the garbage. Don't put it in your compost pile or flush it down the toilet, because then you're just spreading the potential pathogens throughout the systems.
Gwen, thank you very much for calling. You can join in, too. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can shoot us an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here talking about canning and preserving foods with Christina Ward, a certified master food preserver from Milwaukee County. At 11:45 today, we'll be talking about the health of our soils in the state. And then at 12:30, we'll look at the Brewers and Major League Baseball. But right now, we're talking canning and preserving. And and we've got a number of questions, but I want to get, for those who haven't done it, let's just, what do you need to actually get started in canning?
So for canning, there, Gwen had mentioned a pressure canner. Those are more of an advanced tool. You can use a hot water bath canner, essentially a vessel to boil jars in. Those can cost a little money too, but also the Ball Canning Company makes something called the Discovery Kit that essentially is all the tools you need, a basket, a grabber, and the measurement stick and a funnel that gets you started. And that means any stock pot can become your canning pot. So that is thing one. The other thing you need is a tested, safe recipe. And what we mean by tested is it's been tested by the consortium of the universities that make up the Center for Home Food Preservation. And those are universities through the extension offices throughout the entire country that share knowledge and test it to make sure that you are kept safe. And Wisconsin has a number of recipes available freely on the website. So if you just type in State of Wisconsin canning recipes on your website, it'll take you there. And you've got all of the methodology listed out, exactly the steps and how to do it and the ratios and the recipes. And so that is a fantastic first step if you are canning curious.
And, you know, I'm thinking back, if you've got great grandma's canning publication, that is not the one to use necessarily. And I'm thinking about tomatoes. Tomatoes used to be very high acid, and as an example, and now they're not.
And that's, you're absolutely right. Is so food can change, especially as our food systems change. And so that is why the Extension Office and all the master food preservers, anybody who knows what they're talking about with canning, is going to tell you, don't use recipes that are essentially before 1994. You can use them as an inspiration. You can use them for nostalgia. But if there is a family recipe or a grandma's recipe that is beloved, but you're not sure if it's safe, that's another place where the extension can help you. And master food preservers, there's a few of us left in the state of Wisconsin, can review your recipe and recommend a few tweaks or offer you a substitute that is going to get you the same result, but will be safe, and you won't end up poisoning your family.
Okay. Jody in Brooklyn has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Jody.
Hi. I actually have two questions. The one first being, a friend and I just recently got together and canned a lot of pickles in a hot water bath, and some of the lids appeared to be sealed but buckled. And we were concerned that maybe it was an off-brand because we had a variety of lids that we were going through. So I'd like your thoughts on that. And the second question is, how do you feel about the use of a steam canner?
Okay, so I can answer both of those. I'm going to answer the second one first. The steam canner, The University of Wisconsin was the organization that actually tested that to say it is safe to use only, but only for very short duration canning projects, specifically jams and jellies, for processing essentially under 15 minutes. It is safe for that. Other products like, say, for your pickles, which require a longer processing time, that's not so good because it runs out of steam and you can't kind of stop halfway and do it. So that's where a steam canner is good and applicable. It uses less water, so some folks do enjoy those. Buckled lids. Let's talk about buckled lids. Buckled lids are usually a result of a user error, I'm sorry to say. And so my troubleshooting would first be is like, were the bands over tightened? That can cause lid buckling. Was there enough headspace? And headspace is the negative space between the liquid in a pickle, the pickling solution, and the top of the jar. Was there enough headspace? If there's not enough headspace, sometimes you'll get buckling. And what was the processing time? Were you processing to the exact recommended time for a quart of pickles, your standard dill pickles? That's 25 minutes. If you're over 25 minutes, you're going to get mushy pickles and you might end up with buckled lids. Without being in the kitchen with you, those would be my three troubleshooting suggestions to kind of analyze and see if that applies to your situation.
Yeah, and then you can't really, if you can't go back and recan those. Well, you can, but you're going to get really mushy pickles.
Super mushy. The answer always is eat them right away. Eat them sooner, put them in the fridge, make a pickle relish, you know, and just use it up.
That's a good idea. Jody, there you go. Thank you so much. Margaret in Fort Atkinson, your turn. Hi, Margaret.
Hi. Hi. I make sun pickles every year, and I boil the water and vinegar, or the brine, and then I put it all in jars with the pickles and 4 days in the sun. The last couple of years, I put garlic cloves in the bottom, and they've turned kind of a olive green. Is that okay?
Okay. I've got questions for you about sun pickles. What do you do with those jars of pickles after you leave them out in the sun for 4 days?
I put them in the refrigerator.
Oh, that is the absolute 100% correct answer, and I'm so happy to hear that.
And they last all year. I never have to buy a jar, but it's just interesting that this is the second year in a row where, you know, I don't seal. I just shut the lid really tight.
And that's a great way to do it. So what you're getting is you're getting the pickling solution, the vinegar helping to preserve the pickles, and then a little bit of fermentation in the sun. But to your question about the garlic, there's nothing wrong with the garlic. That is a natural phenomenon that happens with the vinegar. It usually happens with older garlic. So if you have older garlic, it tends to turn green or blue. It does not negatively affect the pickles. The pickles are safe to eat, though the natural human reaction to that color of food is repulsion. So don't feel compelled to eat the clove of garlic. But if you do, it won't hurt you.
Not going to hurt you, Margaret. Thank you for calling. Sammy in Stevens Point. Hi, Sammy.
Hi. Hi. It's Tammy.
Oh, Tammy. Sorry.
That's okay. Yeah, I had canned a couple years back some dilly beans. My daughter was going through cancer, and that's what she requested. So I might have made too many cases. Now I have a couple. I probably have about 24 jars yet. I was wondering how long they are safe to eat.
So the official recommendation, if they've been properly, like for dilly beans, hot water bath, canned, processed, they are ideal within 12 months from the date you can them. And then usually then if you have another 6 months, keep close eye on those jars. Have I personally gone 2 years with a canned good? I have. I'm not going to lie to listeners. But with that, you're coming up on that 2-year mark, I'd be very cautious and make sure that those beans look the correct color. The color of the beans should be the same color as the day you took them out of the canner. If they look a little faded, grayish or brown, those are not good. And I wouldn't eat those at all. So if you still have 20 jars and you're coming up on that between that 18 months to 24 month period, it's time for a dilly bean party or a Bloody Mary party with lots of dilly beans in them. So give those to the neighbors and use them up sooner than later.
There you go, Tabby. Thank you for calling. And let's go to Cindy in Madison. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. I have a family member who can have very limited sodium, and I'm wondering if it's possible to can whole tomatoes or tomato sauce without adding salt.
Absolutely, yes, you can. And special diets, regardless of how they come about, is a great jumping off part to explore canning and other forms of food preservation. So yes, because the preserving element in a tomato sauce is the acidification and not the salt. The salt is there for flavor. So you can absolutely take the salt out. And as long as you keep the acidification in your tomato sauce, you're good. You're good to can it.
So would you add some lemon juice or something to it?
So ideally for acidification, 2 tablespoons of lemon juice, bottled lemon juice per quart is the official recommendation. You could substitute that out with a vinegar. Some people like to use 5% at least. You know, you can use a flavored vinegar, and that is the same preservative. The idea is, again, to acidify the whole batch of tomatoes, so to keep it safe from pathogens, to make it unfriendly for pathogens.
I have, and Cindy, thank you so much for calling. You can join in, too, by the way. Let me give that number again, because we have open lines. Get you on pretty quickly. It's 800-642-1234, or email to talk at WPR.org. And Kent in Reedstown emailed us, and he has an Instapot, so do I, and wonders, can you use an Instapot for canning?
No, let me shout it from the mountaintops. No. What makes a pressure canner an effective tool for canning is that you can control both the time and the pressure in that machine. An Instant Pot is set for a time, but you can't really control the pressure the same way. It's kind of a set it and forget it. It's great for cooking, but not for canning. Then the old kind of joke goes is a you can cook in a canner, but you can't can in a cooker. So if it's a pressure cooker, you can't really can in it.
Okay. Listener call, couldn't stay with us. It's not directly a canning question, but is there a device that could catch pears from a tree before they fall on the ground? Just a casual person, not a farmer. Somebody like Clara, probably, who's got 5 peach trees and she can't reach them all because she's not tall enough.
Yeah, that's always the bane. I'm laughing because if you were on my grandmother's farm, her answer would be children. There's kids out there all the time monitoring. For picking high branches, there is something called a claw, kind of a fruit claw, and it looks kind of like a grim medieval weapon, but it's got a little claw that can hook on to the stems, and it has a basket, and you can attach it to like a broomstick, essentially, and it extends your reach by a good 6-7 feet to help you grab those. And that is a great way to make sure you're harvesting all of pears and apples and peaches. But is there a tool to kind of catch them? Not really. A lot of times you'll see the old ways to put like an old bed sheet underneath the tree and try to catch the bruisers that are falling to the ground. But that's always a race against you, against the squirrels, against the wasps. So sadly, it's more of if you've got a productive pear tree, is to kind of keep at it every day when they start coming in and just try to pick when you can.
Bob in Madison has a question. Hi, Bob.
Hey, Larry. I'm wondering if she has an opinion on whether to can tomatoes or freeze tomatoes.
All right. Are you talking about whole tomatoes here, Bob? Or
yeah. I've done them both ways, but I usually slice the tomatoes if I'm going to put them in a freezer Ziploc bag and freeze them.
And then how do you use the tomatoes when you take them out of the freezer?
Well, just for cooking if I want to make chili or something in the wintertime.
Okay.
So, Bob, I have opinions about a lot of things, and what you're doing is perfectly wonderful. People forget often that freezing, which is the act of reducing the temperature, and the reduction of the temperature also prevents pathogens. And so when we talk about food preservation, we're just talking about erecting barriers against pathogens to keep our food preserved for longer, for making it last longer. And so as long as you're adding in a little bit of lemon juice into your tomatoes, which just helps prevent any discoloration and keeps them a little fresher, you can definitely freeze tomatoes. Ideally, about a year is, and people will notice if you find in the bottom of the chest freezer, you know, the thing that's 5 years old, and those aren't going to have very much flavor and they have a bit of freezer burn. So as long as you date your bags so you know your rotation of tomatoes, freezing is a perfectly wonderful way to do it. If, though, you are in a place that maybe has unstable electricity, or is prone to have power outages, then you may want to consider canning them because that makes it shelf stable and less reliant on electricity, which is, of course, what a freezer requires.
Yeah, I had a chest freezer. I had two, and the second one, when we moved, I had to go down in that chest freezer, and I'm looking at what's... Oh, 3 years ago, there's that, you know, and I'm thinking, I'm not going to use a chest freezer anymore just for that very reason. Now I have a kind of a side-by-side, and it doesn't hold as much, but I can find everything.
I think it's a curse of aging a bit, as, you know, if you don't have a larger family to feed, you realize that you can downsize your chest freezer, which is a perfectly okay thing to do. And notice, too, is something that I do is I freeze and I can, because I have different purposes. A lot of times what I recommend is think about how you want to use that fruit or vegetable. And once you think about that, then the correct preservation method presents itself, whether it's dehydration or canning or freezing.
Darwin in Waniwak, we'll go to you. Hi, Darwin.
Hi, good. Thanks for taking my call. I'm driving to West House to help a lady friend clean out her basement after the flood in West Palace.
Yeah.
And we come upon some quart jars of tomatoes. And right away, I say, let's pitch them. And she says she wants to hold on to them. There's an air gap in the lid. You can't see where there's water inside. They still look like tomatoes. I don't know.
There's an air gap in the lid.
Yeah. So it's not like water got inside the, you know. But it was underwater by 5 feet at least.
Oh, man.
That's the key. That was going to be my question. So what you're seeing is an air gap. That's what we call the headspace. That is supposed to be there. They were sealed. That's fantastic. But they were submerged in water. The exteriors are exposed to pathogens. And honestly, unless I was literally starving to death, I would not eat those. And I would make sure and put those in a very, you know, like a heavy duty contractor bag, seal that up and throw those away. And it's always a shame. I know people in Milwaukee area, and I live in the Milwaukee area. I have friends and family who've suffered some losses in these recent floods. And I know it's a heartbreaker to have to throw away so much of your personal belongings and the things you created, but it's just not safe.
No. I remember Mary Menes telling me a story. Mary was a food scientist at the UW-Madison. She's long retired, but she told me a story of a Milwaukee person who wondered about a can of something. I forgot what it was. And she thought, well, I'll open it up. And she wondered, it didn't smell okay. So she put a toothpick in the can, and then she put the tip of the toothpick on her tongue, and then she spent the next year in the hospital.
Wow.
Botulism.
Wow.
And somehow managed to survive. But
Larry, that's an incredible story, and such why the work is important, where it sometimes it may seem like food is a little frivolous thing to talk about, but why we need to talk about food preservation and doing it correctly is exactly that reason. Because if you do it incorrectly, or if you're a little too cavalier with your food safety, you can get very, very sick. And I know no one ever wants that on their conscience, that they've made someone else sick.
John emailed us. He has lots of potatoes this year and wonders, how hard are they to can, and do you need to use a pressure cooker? John has one, but never used it. He always used the water bath method.
Oh, I'm making faces. I'm cringing because, one, hot water bath canning is not recommended. It is very dangerous for potatoes because potatoes are low acid. The ideal method to preserve potatoes is with a pressure canner, not a pressure cooker, a pressure canner. And once you have a pressure canner, potatoes work up wonderfully. It is fantastic, especially if you've got, like, you can do whole peeled peeled small whole ones. You can do chunks in water, a little salt in the pressure canner, and they turn out wonderful. But you've got to use the pressure canner.
Now, what's the difference between the pressure canner and the pressure cooker?
And this goes back to what you were talking about with this, the question with the Instant Pot. Is with a pressure cooker, you're just having pressure and it's on, it's off, right? You can put the little thing in to let release the valve. There's no control over the actual temperature. And in pressure canning, it's critical that we get our temperature to a certain amount for specific types of foods. For potatoes, that temperature is a little different than it is for meat. And so having a pressure canner, which has that regulated temperature control, is the differential between a cooker and a canner, and critical for having successful pressure canning.
John emailed us. John loves jardinera in oil.
Oh, okay.
Anytime he looks for at-home recipe, he gets the botulism warning, then the vinegar directions. Is there a safe way to make commercial oil-rich jardinera? I'm not pronouncing that correctly, I don't think.
Jardinera, you're pretty close, Larry. Jardinera is a really popular condiment, especially on Chicago hot dogs, kind of Italian-American. The thing is you can't do that. There are some things that you just can't quite do safely in a hot water bath canner. And jardinera is one of them because of the oil. The oil as a fat is very low in acid. Now, is it possible to do that in a pressure canner? Theoretically, yes. But because it's made up of like peppers and small little pieces of vegetable, it essentially gets just mushified. And so that's one of those that you just have to get that one at the store and to do it safely. And why a commercial maker, they have different equipment than is available to us at home. So there are a few items that we just can't replicate at home, and that jardinera is one of them.
Marilyn emailed us. She bought a Ball product, citric acid for canning tomatoes, instead of adding lemon juice. But she doesn't see any direction on how to use per size of jar. Could you advise, please? And thanks for the great show, she says.
Oh, well, that's very kind. So citric acid is essentially, that is the same acid in citrus fruit, citrus. And so off the top of my head, and you should look on at the Center for Home Food Preservation to just double check, but it's approximately a teaspoon of citric acid per quart jar to get you to the acidification that you need.
How much is it again?
One teaspoon. The smaller tea, not the big tea.
Okay. There you go, Marilyn. Jean emailed us. When Jean cans dill pickles, she adds a grape leaf to the bottom of the jar. It's from her great aunt.
So that is a very old way. It was believed that grape leaf and leaves like that added essentially a crispness to your dill pickles. It's lovely. It looks nice. It won't harm you, but it really doesn't add anything to the pickles. It doesn't make them crisper. What makes for the crispest pickles is freshness. And so once you get your pickling cukes, you want to move with speed and purpose and get those into the jar as soon as you can, like within 24 hours.
Nevertheless, Gene, I advise you to keep adding that great leaf because you will then remember your great aunt every time you do it. So go ahead. Not going to help, but you're going to remember your aunt, and that's the good thing. Sarah Jane and Madison emailed us. Their household, which is familiar with both water bath and pressure canning, has begun a flagship exploration into fermentation of cucumber pickles, hot sauce, kimchi, and sauerkraut. Understands that after the initial fermentation period, the process can be slowed nearly to a halt by placing products into refrigeration. But I'm deeply curious regarding any method that could be used for more sophisticated preservation at home. At the grocery store, one can purchase a sealed jar of lacto-fermented pickles advertising live probiotics. However, because bacteria, health, or otherwise are killed in heated environments, Sarah Jane wonders what the method is to safely seal, cool, and consume live, actively cultured foods.
So you're onto something. You found the marketing glitch because the heat is going to destroy any of those kind of the probiotic benefits of it. And so if there's a brand claiming that it's heat processed, shelf stable, and still probiotic, then I'm curious as how they were able to do that. That it sounds a little bit akin to the old cereal marketing of fortified with vitamins. I'm not quite sure how they're getting that probiotic in there, and I'm very suspect. Again, you rightly point out is that colder temperatures slow down the fermentation process, which is why if you're looking for a type of a pickle, a fermented pickle, a kimchi, anything like that, you'll find that in the cool section of your grocery store. And that's ideally where it should be.
So what's your favorite thing to preserve?
I have a sweet tooth, and I will always evangelize about pie filling. I love making pie fillings. You can be very fun and creative, and they're more versatile than you think they might be. So you can make more than pie. It works great as an ice cream topping. You can use it like a little pound cake, make a strawberry shortcake. But if you had peach pie filling, you could do a peach shortcake. So number one on my hit parade is always pie filling.
I like how you think, Christina. Thank you so much for being with us today. Oh, man, I hope we can do this again. Will you come back and be with us again?
It's a pleasure to speak with you, Larry, and to take the calls. I love trying to help people. And let's hope that everybody has a great harvest season and all of your jars seal.
May all of your jars seal. That's a good way to end it. Thanks, Christina. Oh, man. Christina Ward, a certified master food preserver for Milwaukee County. You can tell she enjoys her work, and she's darn good at it. It's great talking with her. We'll get her back. Next, we're going to be talking about the health of soil in our state. You'll hear from Jamie Patton, the acting state agronomist and soil health coordinator with the Wisconsin Natural Resources Conservation Service. That coming up next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're appreciating Wisconsin's soil resources here on WPR News. And Jamie Patton is with us to help us in that task. She's the acting state agronomist and soil health coordinator with the Wisconsin Natural Resources Conservation Service. As we talk with her, I hope you'll join in with your questions. Maybe you have some questions about your own soil's health. Let us know how you've improved the soil in your area. Give us a call. The number, 800 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Jamie Patton, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Larry. I'm excited to be here.
So what's your role? You're the acting state agronomist and soil health coordinator for Wisconsin NRCS. What do you do in that role?
I do a lot of things. So as the agronomist, my job is to help a lot of our field offices with putting conservation practices on the ground. So I serve as a technical expert, you know, trying to provide those recommendations of how we put in cover crops, you know, what kind of tillage might we use in these situations, you know, how do we best utilize nutrients in the environment. As a soil health coordinator, I get to talk about soil all day long, and that is my favorite thing to do. Hopefully that comes through.
You know, I was thinking back to when I took a soils UW-Madison class when I was an undergraduate in soils. I wasn't majoring in soils, but I had to take the class, or I needed to take the class, wanted to. And kids would in this who were majoring in soils would some. I'd tell them what I was taking, and they'd say, "Oh, you're taking dirt 300.
And those are fighting words.
And I tell you what, you would not say that in front of a professor for sure. And maybe you can tell us the difference between soil and dirt.
I would love to talk about the difference between soil and dirt, because dirt is a dirty word. We don't use that. We only in very specific situations. So soil, right? And the key with soil, and I can give you the textbook definition, right? It's a dynamic natural body composed of minerals, organic matter, air, and water that acts on and is acted upon by living organisms, right? And that's the key, is making sure that people understand that soil is alive and that we need to treat it as such. It's an ecosystem and it serves a purpose. It has function. Dirt, on the other hand, we typically talk about it as what you're tracking into the house on the bottom of your shoes or what you vacuum up out of the car, right? So soil is that natural body that keeps us healthy, keeps us breathing, keeps us fed.
So we need to keep it healthy. And why? Why is healthy soil important in our state?
And this is what's really fun. When you and I went to college, we did not use these words, right? Soil health is a fairly new concept, meaning it's come about in about the last 20 or so years as we've understood and starting to understand, we don't quite understand all of it just yet, that the soil is alive and that plethora of living organisms out there in the soil and what they do for us, from nutrient cycling to helping our soil aggregate. So when a soil aggregates, it gets into those little clumps, right? We all know if we pick up a soil and it falls through our hands and it looks like chocolate cake crumbs or cookie crumbs, that's a good soil. All of that involves biology. So when we talk about soil health, we oftentimes concentrate on that biological portion that we didn't know much about when I went to college, you know, a few decades ago. We focused on chemistry. Now we focus on those living organisms and how they make a soil do what it needs to do.
And it does so many things in the ecosystem. I mean, it regulates water, for one thing.
Without a doubt. And so when we think about, you know, plants, I enjoyed listening to your last guest, right? Talking about the plethora of things that we can, right? As we think about food production out there and we think about those plants, right? We always think about those plants get from the soil their wants, water, air, nutrients, temperature and toxin regulation, and a structure for support. And so when we think about that soil, that regulation of water and that supply of water over the season is key. They don't take up water typically through their leaves. They're going to take it up through the root system. So we have to have a soil that holds water. We have to have a soil that regulates nutrients, right? That cycles nutrients out of that compost that we're adding. You know, this composted manure cycling naturally out of the organic matter. All of that comes into play when we talk about soil. And so it's really key that we manage that beautiful natural body in a way that we keep it functioning so that we have food, that we have air, and that, right, as we think about all the rain that we've gotten, all that water soaks into the ground, or a lot of that water soaks into the ground rather than running off, creating flooding and erosion.
I've got a lot, many more comments relating to that, but Nancy in Duluth has a question. So let's go there. Nancy, hi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. I love your show. I'm so glad to hear it again because I didn't have radio for a while. So I used to live in southern Minnesota where there's a lot of soil problems, and there's a group that's still active called Land Stewardship Project, and they help farmers and growers take good care of the soil and keep it that way. And here's what their motto is: let's stop treating our soil like dirt.
I love that. Well, Nancy, thanks for calling. Jamie, are you kind of familiar with a land stewardship program?
We are, and there's a lot of wonderful, great nonprofits out there that are really embracing this idea of soil health and helping everyone from landowners through farmers figure out how they can promote soil health on all sorts of scales, from the backyard up through fields. So, yeah, that is a good mantra to follow. Don't treat your soil like dirt.
Nancy, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, yeah, thinking about soil, our constant concerns relate to pollution, and I think soil plays a role in filtering pollutants, does it not?
Without a doubt. And what's really exciting about soil is most of us don't recognize that soil is charged, right? It's dominantly negatively charged. And why that's important is it helps to filter out many of the chemicals, whether they be nutrients or other types of chemicals that are introduced into the soil system. So from the impact of that charge on the soil, helping to hold those contaminants in the soil, and then that biology coming into play to help to decompose and detoxify some of those chemicals, or if we're talking about nutrients, utilize those nutrients and put them back into the plant cycle, it's key, like I said. And so, yeah, soils are nature's recycling center, right? If they weren't, right, we'd be above our heads in, dead cricket bodies or whatever, and leaves and everything else, right? Those things disappear. We take that for granted, but that's that nature's recycling center helping to detoxify and recycle a lot of what we add to the soil.
Let me put it this way. How much would you consider soil to be a renewable resource?
I don't, right? So this is where we oftentimes talk about renewable versus non-renewable. In our lifetime, right, the definition, I think, of a renewable resource is something that we can regenerate in our lifetime. Depending upon the climate, scientists believe it takes somewhere between maybe 700 and 1,000 years to form 1 inch of soil. So a little bit of soil loss is going to take our lifetime or more to replace. So it is a non-renewable resource. While I can regenerate what I have, right, I can restore the fertility and I can restore that biological community. If the soil itself is lost, it's lost. I'm not going to see it come back in my lifetime.
And I was thinking, I was trying to remember, if you took a bathtub and filled it up with soil, that'd be about a ton of soil, wouldn't it?
Oh, goodness. Sure. I've never done that. Maybe that's what I'll do after the show.
Art Peterson might have told me that one time, soil scientist at the UW, rest his soul. But I was thinking about the tons of topsoil that may be lost, by perhaps poor conservation methods over the course of a year. And it can be into the tons of soil per acre.
It can. And so when we think about it, I'm more versed in thinking about 5 tons. So I know what that looks like when spread out over an acre, right? It's about the thickness of a dime. And so when we talk about losing soil from our gardens, our yards, from our agricultural fields, when you think about the thickness of a dime, it's not that much, right? And that's oftentimes what we consider to be, for many of our soils, tolerable soil loss. So, and...
Yeah, if you spread 5 bathtubs full of soil, that'd probably be about the thickness of of a dime over an acre. We're going to talk some more with Jamie Patton, acting state agronomist, and I hope you'll join in as we talk soil with her Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. We're going to take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us. And then we will be back with Jamie Patton. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're getting an update about soil quality in our state today. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for being with us on WPR News. Jamie Patton with us. She's the acting state agronomist and soil health coordinator with the Wisconsin Natural Resources Conservation Service. So maybe you wonder what soil is exactly, and maybe how to improve it. Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. And we've got callers online, so let's go to the phones and to Judy and Tomahawk first. Judy, hi.
Well, hi. A little while ago, I read a book about the Great Hinckley, Minnesota Fire, which I think occurred around the late 1800s. And in the book, the author said that they lost 12 feet of topsoil due to the high temperatures. And I read that quite a few times. I couldn't believe it. Is that possible to have 12 feet of topsoil?
That's where I'm going to have to read that book. when we think about it, what might have happened? And so what I'm trying to think, so soil is mineral, right? It's little rocks, so sand, silts, and clays. So fire doesn't really have an impact on, you know, making rocks disappear. What it does do, and those high temperatures can make organic matter so that those dead plant and animal remains disappear. So what I could imagine is what they might have been talking about are those peatlands, right? Those bogs where we have large amounts of organic matter, tens of feet of organic matter. Then potentially if a fire came through, that organic matter would have been burnt away, and that's how they might have lost those 12 feet. But I'm not familiar with this situation, but we hear about this in history, right? So when we think about those stories coming out of Ireland where they, you know, they mined the peat and dried it out and then used it to heat their homes in the winter, it's the same concept. And Minnesota does have similar peat soils in some areas as to those situations. So
yeah,
that's
could be. What's the normal depth of, let's say, the average depth of soil in our state?
So that's a good question. So what we've been talking about is topsoil. And so topsoil is the common person's description of that upper dark layer, right? So soil scientists have a name for it. We're really creative. It's called the A horizon. that topsoil, that dark layer, is going to depend upon how that soil forms. So soils that typically form under prairies, so that would have formed under grasses over thousands of years, could have a foot, 2 foot, 3 foot thick or more dark layer on the soil surface. In Wisconsin, many of our soils formed under forests. And because of how that situation sits up and the tree roots don't die back, our forest soils tend to have only a few inches of topsoil. So it really depends upon the history and how that soil formed over time as to how much topsoil it has, plus where it's on the landscape, how we manage it, so on and so forth. So tough question to answer.
Judy, thank you very much for your question. Mike and Poinette, what's on your mind?
Hi. Well, as plants need soil to grow, I thought this was an interesting topic because I'm dealing with a plant that I'm trying to get rid of. And I'm wondering if there's something that I can do with my soil to assist me with that. I have daughter on my shoreline, and it's really tough to get rid of. I've been pulling it, and I don't really want to use herbicide on it, but I just thought maybe there's something I could do to modify the soil so that daughter wouldn't grow in it, or it would hinder it a little.
So that's going to be a tough one. So those shoreline soils are tend to be very sensitive, and we have to manage them appropriately, right? Because they're helping us to filter those nutrients in that water before it enters into the water body. So while I am not an expert on dodder control, I think that is probably your best bet. It's not going to be a changing the soil itself, but a little old labor there of pulling that dodder out. Unless someone else knows better, this is not usually...
Not usually
how I would approach controlling weeds is changing the soil.
Yeah, I had a friend who was got some help from some friends and did a little pulling content. And once you got it pulled and cleared, then it's easier to, you know, when they come back to pick them up and pick them out as they reoccur.
Right. Because I could make recommendations so that the dodder wouldn't grow. The problem is nothing else would either. So yeah. that's not what we want to do.
So. Mike, sorry, but keep pulling. Keep trying. Brian in Madison, your turn. Hi, Brian.
Hi. A number of years ago, I used to go down to Verona Road, and there was a small mountain of black earth from the composting efforts of the community. I would go there and I would see literally scores of people filling up the backs of their station wagons and trailers. That has long gone and it hasn't been replaced. And wondering what efforts this good state of Wisconsin could make to reintroduce composting on a community basis for those of us who don't compost. I personally compost and have for many years, but there's lots of us that don't. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for calling, Brian. What about it, Jamie? I'm assuming there are still communities doing that.
There are. And so particularly, so I'm not from Madison, so I live up north. So a lot of our communities, it's a great way to recycle the leaves and sticks that come out of our urban areas. And so a lot of municipalities are working on composting initiatives. The challenge is it takes labor, right? So to make sure that compost, you just don't let it sit and it does its thing. It has to be tended. It has to be managed, watered, turned, so on and so forth. So there are still several municipalities out there that are doing this. Like I said, it's going to take some funding efforts and some grassroots efforts to get this to flourish, and probably a better understanding, right, of how good compost and recycling those materials can be for improving soil health, right? So it helps to create a sponge, right? Soils hold water better. It's providing nutrients. And again, if we go back to that key thing of that soil being alive, that compost is just food for those billions and trillions of organisms that I love so much in those soils. So it's a great way to feed those organisms as well. So compost is super beneficial. That is, but getting municipalities to take on composting again can be quite a challenge.
Brian, thank you very much for calling. Are there any good T-shirts that advertise and extol the virtues of soil?
There are. So they tend to be a little nerdy, right? So soil scientists, you'll see them all over. My favorite one. So if you're familiar, I'm sure you might be familiar, Larry, with Lus, the windblown sediment, right? So yeah. I have one that says looking for Lus in all the wrong places, right? Because it only occurs on, yeah. But like I said, they tend to be pretty nerdy. Otherwise, I have a wonderful one, the Anago silt loam shirt, right? So if people don't know, we have a state soil. It's the Anago silt loam. It has its own song. So if you don't have your own Anago silt loam shirt, I encourage you to go out and find one and represent the beautiful soils here in Wisconsin.
I live a couple of blocks from where Francis Hole, UW soil scientist, lived. There's a plaque out there recognizing him, and he was he got his students organized and got Anago silt loam as the state soil. And I think I've mentioned on the show in the past, he used to bring a violin to his classes, and and he'd say, "Well, here's what sandy soil sounds like," and he'd do sandy soil, and here's what Anago silt loam sounds like, and he'd do that. He was a great lecturer, and oftentimes his classes would be filled with the seats all filled, and then a lot of people who weren't even in the class just standing back there listening to him speak. He's quite a guy.
fantastic. I never got to meet him, unfortunately. So,
Antigo silk loam. What's so good about Antigo silk loam?
It's a beautiful soil. So, like I said, I believe they chose it because it is what's considered prime farmland. So it's a prime, that's the mantra. It's a prime Wisconsin soil, meaning that it has the biological, chemical, and physical properties that make it good for agricultural production. So we're going to see a particular near Antigo, right? A lot of our wonderful seed potatoes are being grown on the Antigo silt loam itself. But if you ever have a chance, right, there's a beautiful placard. If you can't go to Dr. Hole's house, there's a beautiful placard monumenting the Antigo silt loam as a state soil up in the town of Antigo at the airport. So
there you go.
Again, nerdy things, right?
nerdy things indeed. What are the most common soil types that we, of course, Antigo silt loam is one of them, but what else do we have here in our state?
So when we think about soils, much like biology, we have a classification system. And so the highest order of classification is what we call are the orders, right? And so we have in the state of Wisconsin an alpha soil. So we have these beautiful forest-derived soils that have that thinner topsoil like I talked about, and they have this heavy clay accumulation in the B horizons. Those take up much of the state. Those who are lucky enough to live down in the Madison area and in southern Wisconsin, you're going to have this another kind of soil called a mollisol. It's those beautiful dark prairie-derived soils, like we talked about, having thick topsoil and make it easier for us to garden in and grow our lawns and to farm in. And if you go way up north, we have these wonderful soils called spodosols, which are just wildly beautiful, bright white colors in the subsoil. You don't really want to farm them or grow vegetables on them. They're best left in their native tree vegetation. But we have a very diverse array of soils in Wisconsin, and that's why I'm here, right? There's always something to learn.
John was actually wondering in an email, what is your day-to-day job like?
What is my day-to-day job like? So what I do is I said, for the NRCS, the Natural Resources Conservation Service, we are a voluntary conservation organization, right? And we have government programs to help put conservation on the ground. So as a technical person, I'm out learning the science. I'm learning what producers are doing, and I'm helping to provide guidance for when our field office staff, when our conservationists go out and help make recommendations to those farmers. So I'm the let's call it in the most simple terms, kind of like the scientific liaison. I'm taking the greatest research that's coming out of the country, that's coming out of UW, and I'm formulating that into an action plan for the state of Wisconsin.
Listener called, couldn't stay with us, wonders, do chemicals from fireworks affect soil health?
They can. And so when we think about anything that we add to the soil can potentially increase or decrease soil health, right? It's however they impact soil biology. So the nice thing about soils is they tend to be pretty resilient. So while fireworks and the leftover chemicals that are oftentimes they're going to be salts that are left over after the combustion process, the soil is going to be impacted in the immediate area as well as in that immediate time period. But over time, those organisms are adapted to oftentimes detoxify, to utilize, and water is going to help flush out those salts over time. And so while we might have an immediate effect on many of the things that we add to the soil, over the long term, the soil oftentimes can heal itself or take care of itself and regenerate itself over time.
Many years ago, I worked on an agency for international development program in Jamaica, because they were losing in some of their hillier areas of the country, I think it was 30 tons of topsoil per acre per year. And so as a communications person, my role was to help in education and so forth. But I'm wondering, and I can't remember the how many tons of per acre we were losing in Wisconsin. I think that's gotten a lot better over the years.
It has. And you mentioned me right before we went to break, you heard me mention the words tolerable soil loss. So tolerable soil loss is the amount of soil that we're estimated to be able to lose and still maintain the productivity of the soil. And so to put that 30 tons in perspective, Larry, that you just said, many of our soils in Wisconsin have a tolerable soil loss of somewhere between 1 and 5 tons. So nothing like 30 tons. Like that's losing soil at 6 times the rate in which it would naturally regenerate itself and maintain productivity. So in the state of Wisconsin, with changes to increased grazing, to the things such as cover crops that you see more and more on the ground, growing some of another plant just simply to keep the ground covered. And in, during those non-crop production times of the year, over winter, for example, or looking at perennial vegetation, right? Making sure that we have roots in the ground all year round. All of these things are helping to protect that soil, and our actual soil erosion losses are, depending upon, are going to vary by parts of the state, are oftentimes in that 1 to 3 tons per acre, well within maintaining productivity. So things have gotten a lot better over time, as we understand.
Has technology advanced much in this area of soil protection and so forth?
Without a doubt. And so what's really fun about soil technologies is, you know, if you want to talk about cover crops being a technology, right, when we came out of the Dust Bowl, right? So, you know, the 1938 Yearbook of Agriculture, one of the ways they had prescribed to help build soil after the Dust Bowl was to use cover crops. And then we kind of forgot about it for a few decades, but it's back. And why I say they're new technologies is we're getting new varieties out there. So they're breeding them to be more cold tolerant. So many of these crops that we use as cover crops, and they're fitting into our Wisconsin rotation system. So it may be something such as new genetics, new plants that we're bringing in that are helping us to keep that soil covered and in place and to keep it healthy over time. Or it may just simply be some of the new equipment that we're using. So a lot of the listeners have probably heard about no-till, right? And it's not tilling the ground before you plant your next crop. Well, that takes a lot of technology. There's a lot of sophisticated equipment that is required to get a seed placed in the ground without tilling it. So over the last few decades, the equipment that we use for agriculture has helped us conserve the land as well, because we're doing less disturbance and we're able to utilize some of these practices that we know, such as cover crops that build soil health over time.
It's amazing what some of that equipment can do as you drive over the land and locating fertilizer or nutrient deficiencies or excesses from one yard to the next.
And there's this new, so if you live in an area, it's called 360 rain. It's one of the new irrigation technologies that we have out there. It's autonomous. So it just goes out and it wanders around the field, but drives up and down the rows, but not on the crops, applying water and nutrients all on its own.
So, and where it's needed.
So autonomy is coming to many of our practices, which allows, like you said, us to specifically place amendments where they're needed.
And, you know, this applies to as well to our Wisconsin gardeners, our home gardeners. When it comes to, I was thinking cover crops, because we just had a question last week cover crops, somebody wondering about planting, I forgot, was it barley? I can't remember. But go talk about that from a home gardener perspective.
Sure. So when we think about soil, we talk about it, again, it's kind of what I've been talking about the whole time. It's alive. So I want to make sure and feed it over the winter. So home gardeners, you know, when we take out those last crops, that is a perfect time to plant another crop in there that we're not going to harvest. We're just going to either leave it, or it's going to winter kill, but it's there to build organic matter and feed those soil microbes. So things, if they were talking such as winter barley, right?
Barley.
Or winter rye is something that's used very commonly in Wisconsin because it's a little more cold tolerant, but it's after, for that home gardener, after we get that garden ready, and as we're starting to think about putting it to bed, is we would just seed that cereal rye on top, kind of rake it in lightly, and it'll actually germinate before winter comes. So it'll germinate down to about 637 degrees or even less. And then it stays alive over winter, and those roots are helping to feed that soil biology. And as soon as it warms up in the spring, it starts to grow and it provides that beautiful soil cover. We can use it as a living mulch. There's all sorts of wonderful things. Putting legumes in these cover crop mixes, if we get them in early, are going to help us supply free nitrogen to our next crop, because they're legume crops and they can fix that nitrogen. So cover crops oftentimes we utilize them in home gardens, not only to provide nutrients, to improve soil health, but like I said, to add organic matter over time and to suppress those weeds that we all just really don't like to have in our garden.
And I think with cover crops, you need to, they need to be cut or removed before they go to seed.
Most definitely. And so this is where, for example, if you're putting in many of the cover crops after you your harvest season, like I said, choosing something that winter kills, so it grows in the fall and then it gets frost terminated, is a great way to add a little bit more organic matter. And if it does overwinter, right, so if for those who are comfortable using a herbicide, use a herbicide. Otherwise, they can easily, if they're at the smaller growth stages, you can just till them in and get ready for your next crop. But lots of options there, and so there's no one prescription. That's why I'm kind of stumbling here, is knowing what our goals are, and then we have lots of options for cover crops and how we want to use them to meet our gardening goals.
And somebody else is wondering, what's the difference between between the carbon in the atmosphere and the carbon in the soil? Interesting.
So it is an interesting question. So it is a cycle, right? So when we think about, I talked about the nutrient cycle, the water cycle, but it is also the carbon cycle. So when we think about those plants, right, they're taking carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, converting them into sugar into their own plant bodies. And then as that vegetation dies and gets into the soil, it decomposes. Some of it will go back to the atmosphere as carbon dioxide, but some of that carbon stays in the soil as the soil organic matter, that dark peaty material that we've been talking about. Soil is intricate, is very much part of, I can't get that word out right now, is very much part of that carbon cycle, helping to store carbon. So if we can increase the amount of organic matter in our soil, we can increase carbon storage. And if we lose that organic matter, right, through decomposition, then that carbon goes right back into the atmosphere. So it's a tight little circle right there. They're very much linked.
I'm thinking about the intense weather we've had recently, and I think our soil health, very important, given the kinds of weather changes we're seeing.
Without a doubt. And so often one of our measures of soil health, if we can go out and we look at our soil and it looks like that chocolate cake structure, it looks like that cookie crumb or cottage cheese, we know that our biology is working and that we have probably a good, healthy soil. Why that's so important with these heavy rainfalls is those cookie crumbs, those cottage cheese type structures, the soil aggregates, they have pore space in between. And the more pore space we can have in a soil, the better water infiltrates. And if water is moving into the soil, then it's not moving off. And if it's not moving off, that means that we're reducing erosion and we're reducing the potential flood impacts. So soils, maintaining soil health, maintaining the soil's capacity to accept or infiltrate water and then store that water is key as we start to see these intense rainfall events, and maintaining that soil on the landscape where it belongs.
Jamie, a pleasure talking with you. Will you come back and be with us again sometime down the road? Love to have you.
Without a doubt. And maybe next time we'll sing the Antigo Silt Loam song.
We'll do a duet.
It's going to be scary. Hopefully you're a better singer than I am.
It'd be pretty scary. Maybe we'll have Lee Rayburn look up the Antigo Silt Loam song that somebody else. I know that Francis Hull knew that song very, very well, and maybe we can find him singing that song. In the meantime, Jamie, thanks again. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Jamie Patton, Acting State Agronomist and Soil Health Coordinator with the Wisconsin Natural Resources Conservation Service. Going to turn our attention to baseball and the Milwaukee Brewers next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.
Salty, no, Wisconsin's crops and livestock grow, and forest too on Antigo, and forest too on Antigo.
Turning our attention to baseball now and the Milwaukee Brewers, talking about the Brewers and Major League Baseball today with our two guests back with us once again, Paul Noonan and Ryan Topp, hosts of the podcast. It's titled Milwaukee's Tailgate Brewers Podcast. Always fun to listen to them. And as we talk with them today, I hope you'll join in. What are your predictions for the rest of the Brewers season? Let us know maybe your favorite moment from the Brewers season so far, or maybe you've tried a pocket pancake. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. Paul and Ryan, welcome back. Great to have you with us again.
Yeah, great to be here.
Yeah. Well, yesterday, the Brewers took on the Cubs, and, you know, I was concerned because they'd lost and kind of un-Brewer-like fashion to the game before that. But then it was like, all right, we're starting a new round of wins here.
Yeah. The loss was a little unusual just in that they didn't blow the doors off a team. But honestly, they'd had a bit of a run against the Reds in that last series of scraping some lucky ones out. And you know, if you're going to win 14 in a row, you're going to have some luck. You're going to be good, but you're going to get lucky too. No team goes on a streak like this without getting fortunate. And in that game, I think fortune finally came to an end for them. It's going to happen. But, you know, overall, they're just a great team. And so it's not that surprising to see them roll into Chicago and dominate again, because they do that with routine. We should be expecting that of the Brewers at this point. That is the standard they've set.
You know, I saw the story by Ken Rosenthal. You guys probably saw it too, or maybe you didn't. He wrote that that offensive regression before the postseason is inevitable for the Brewers. Ryan, what do you make of that?
I mean, to a certain extent, sure. The Brewers currently do lead baseball in runs per game right now. They're scoring 5.2 runs per game, which is better than even the vaunted LA Dodgers and their $300+ million payroll that they've got. The Brewers are doing that in a lot of different ways. They're not doing it with the kind of power you generally expect, but they are getting on base. And so that's kind of, if you've seen the movie or read the book Moneyball, you know that on base was this wonderfully underrated stat that smart teams sort of figured out that was what they were going to do. And the Brewers excel at getting on base. They're currently second in baseball in terms of on base percentage behind only the Toronto Blue Jays. And so even though they don't hit for a ton of power, they do get on base, and they are, as Pat Murphy likes to call them, the Woodpeckers. They're an extremely annoying team to face. And a big part of that is they make fantastic swing decisions. That's sort of one of the big things in baseball analytics these days is swing decisions. When should you swing? When shouldn't you swing? Optimizing that is really, really important. And the Brewers might be the best in baseball at that. They have a bunch of guys who make really good swing decisions. They don't swing at pitches outside of the strike zone very much. And when they get balls in the strike zone, they tend to kind of go with them and hit them where they need to. And that's led to, you can look at it a bunch of different ways. The Brewers are basically an average team with nobody on base, but when there's runners in scoring position, they're the second best team in baseball in terms of hitting. They're a tremendous two-strike hitting team. They kind of do all these sorts of things very well. And so Ken's probably right that there's a little bit of regression due, but I wouldn't think that it's going to all fall apart and they're just going to completely stop scoring. There's just too many good bats in the lineup for that to probably happen.
Well, and it's amazing that we had a couple of people out for a long period of time, including one of our stars.
Yep.
He was out the entire time and I suddenly blanked on his name.
Jackson Chourio.
Chourio. Yep. He was out for that whole stretch of 14 wins in a row.
Yeah, he was. They are... they're an especially deep team. And just to go back to Moneyball a little bit, I think one of the reasons that Ken might be more wrong than, well, he's a good analyst, but one of the things that's hard to spot in sports is when there has been a new development versus just getting lucky. And when I do sports analysis, I spend most of my time looking for regression to the mean statistics. Guys, we're going to crash back to earth. The Brewers don't have that many of them. And I think a lot of this is because they've been buying and drafting and a specific type of player, which is a player who is going to be amenable to their swing decision coaching and who's good at making contact. And outside of a few guys, almost every Brewers starter is in the top 10% in baseball in speed. So what you end up having is all these guys who can get the bat on the ball, which is not a skill that most teams have. And when they do, they're always going to be putting pressure on the defense to make a really good play to throw them out. Any ground ball to shortstop for the Brewers is like five times as likely to be a single as it is on any other team. And all the rest of baseball is focused so much on getting home run hitters. And you're always going to trade some speed and some agility for a big guy who can hit home runs. And like 85% of the rest of the league just has these guys playing at a bigger, musclier capacity in shortstop and places where they didn't tend to play. And the Brewers are capitalizing on that. They've shifted where the rest of the league hasn't. It's been great.
I've just been watching how many times have Brewers hitters legged out a base hit on, you know, sort of even on a miss hit where it's just a, you know, a, sort of a grounder, the infield hit. They got to be close to leading the league in infield hits.
Yeah, they're up there, and you could just see it in yesterday's game. Yep. The third run that they scored was essentially exactly that. They had the ball was poorly hit and put in play, and I can't remember exactly who the batter was who did it, but it was poorly put in play down the first base line, and they were able to get down the line quick enough that the Cubs were not able to complete the play, and then the ball ends up squirting away from the defender down the line. Yep. And the Brewers are able to then score as a result of that, and you've got that sort of thing going on too. But we shouldn't completely overlook the fact that they've also been getting more power. This lineup has been hitting for more power. Their own guys, Bryce Durang has hit 7 home runs this month after having 6 in the all the time leading up to this month. Sal Frelick is having a breakout power season. But the biggest thing here, and I know Paul wants to talk more about this, is Andrew Vaughn's breakout. Yeah. When they started from the White Sox, he has been a revelation and is truly batting like an MVP. And Paul, you wanted to go
into
that.
Go with Andrew Vaughn. I mean, what a story. Talk about him.
So Andrew Vaughn, I think, is another – people are waiting for him to come back down to earth across the baseball analytics sphere too. And I'm not sure that's going to happen. One of the smartest things you can do in any sports organization is grab guys with really good pedigrees from really poor organizations and teams. And the Chicago White Sox are that. They set a record last year. They don't really know what they're doing. There's been a ton of articles on their front office and how they're just very backwards. Andrew Vaughn was a 3rd overall pick in the Major League Baseball draft. People thought very, very highly of Andrew Vaughn at one point in time. And I just think the White Sox really didn't know how to develop him properly, and that there were a couple of little tweaks that could go a long way. One of the things that Andrew Vaughn did do well, even when he was on the White Sox, was crush balls that were in the strike zone. Very simple thing, right? You want to be good at that. The problem was Andrew Vaughn was swinging at too many things outside of the strike zone. And as Ryan mentioned earlier, one of the things the Brewers are the best, very, very good at coaching is swing decisions. So before he joined the Brewers, Andrew Vaughn was swinging at 36% of pitches outside the zone. And his career average is around 33%. Since joining Milwaukee, that's down to 26%. That is a huge drop. And so if you just don't swing at those, first of all, they're balls, not strikes. So you get up in the count. And then when things are in the zone, he makes contact with the ball 89% of the time. It's usually hard contact. So it's not as easy as just telling a guy, you know, don't swing at bad pitches. The thing the Brewers, I think, are really good at is identifying sort of tells and little ticks out of the pitcher's hand on just don't bother swinging at. If it's an inside breaking ball, don't swing at that. It might be a strike, but live to fight another day on something you can handle a little better. And so I don't think he's going to crash back down to earth because he is clearly making better decisions with what he decides to swing at. That's the change. And so as long as he keeps doing that, he's going to hit like an all-star. So they basically just made an all-star out of nothing. Well, Aaron Civale is not nothing, but and a pitcher they didn't want turned into an all-star first baseman.
It's absolutely amazing to me how these we get people from all over the place, it seems like, who weren't doing anything at all and are performing way underperforming compared to what they're doing now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Isaac Collins would be a perfect example of that, too. He's probably the favorite for Rookie of the Year in the National League right now. He is a 27-year-old. Well, I think he may have just turned 28.
I think he is, yeah.
And he just is coming off paternity leave, so now he's got that dad strength because he just had his first child. But he is having an out-of-nowhere season. He's got an 833 OPS, which is 35% better than the league average, for those that don't know that. So he's been one of the best hitters on the team and has been really, really good. And where did the Brewers get him from? Well, they got him from the sad sack Colorado Rockies. And so once again, they went to a bad team and said, hey, here's a guy that we think we can make better because they're probably not getting the coaching that they would benefit from most. And here's Isaac Collins having a breakout. Now, do we expect that to necessarily last long term? No, it's probably this is probably Isaac Collins' best run of his career. But if you do this often enough, which the Brewers excel at doing this so much, then you could sort of stack these guys up and kind of keep it rolling. And the Brewers always seem to have guys like this, right? Like they always seem to have kind of a guy like this on the roster who's giving more than what you would expect. And so that's not an accident. That's not luck. It's sort of dependent on doing a lot of things right.
And the coaches. I want to talk about the coaches, too, but just to we need to take a little short break here. So let me remind you, we're talking today with Ryan Topp and Paul Noonan. They are the host of the podcast. It's called Milwaukee's Tailgate Brewers Podcast. Give a listen. It's fun to listen to. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk about insects with entomologist Phil Pelletieri. Then we'll cover how you can get involved keeping count of wildlife in our state. And we'll also hear from the new director of the UW Arboretum. That's tomorrow. Today, we're talking about the Brewers with Ryan Topp and Paul Noonan, hosts of Milwaukee's Tailgate Brewers Podcast. Question, you can email us to talk@WPR.org or give a call. The number's 800-642-1234. Love to hear your opinion of the Brewers and how they are doing. Let's go to the coaches. I mean, we have got, I hope they're, you know, they hold back sometimes on what they're paying the players. We keep pretty, what are they, the eighth lowest in the baseball, I think. But I think we're doing better on the coaching side, and I hope we keep that up because we've got some really good coaches. Talk about the coaches for a minute.
Well,
Paul, go ahead.
I can start. Pat Murphy is a big change from Craig Counsell. In Counsell was definitely an implementer of front office strategy more than anything else. Former player, gets along with players. Murphy definitely does some of that because you can't work for the Brewers without having some front office in your ear, but is definitely a philosophical change and one that has worked with this team quite well. First of all, just on being kind of a player's coach goofball, like with pancakes and whatnot, and you know, a guy you can rally around. Counsell's not that. He's a little bit dour. And coaching goes in cycles like this. You know, it's good to have a taskmaster and a serious guy. It's good to have a player's coach. It's kind of good to back and forth on this. But he really does seem to get the most effort out of everybody, if nothing else. And there's a lot to be said for a guy who's good for clubhouse chemistry, for getting everybody on the same page. And so the only bad thing Ryan and I have really ever had to say about Pat Murphy is I think he does use his relief pitchers maybe a little more than he should. He likes to tinker. He likes to get guys in there when maybe not leaving well enough alone. But by and large, the Brewers run a really good strategic team. And you know what? They run such an old school offense right now with singles and speed and stolen bases that maybe having a little bit of an old school manager isn't the worst thing in the world. Pat Murphy's kind of used to calling this kind of game and probably likes calling this kind of game. And it's kind of boring for a manager just to tell guys to go up there, take walks, and hit home runs. So I think it's really been a good coming together of old strategy, new strategy, and a manager who just gets the most out of everything.
Yeah. What about the rest of the group?
Yeah. So Ryan? I think the first guy we should really talk about is Chris Hook, who has been the longtime pitching coach. And he's a fantastic, fantastic pitching coach. But I don't want to single him out so much because this is a whole organizational philosophy from the bottom to the top. The Brewers are known for their pitching lab. Their pitching lab is superb. And so all the way down from the bottom of the organization to the top, they have, and they have a bunch of other pitching coaches too. Their assistant pitching coach is Jim Henderson. They have a bullpen coach. The Brewers have a ton of coaches. It's one of the things that's really happened in baseball lately is teams, the coaching staffs have exploded and teams have just tons of different people on their coaching staffs. Now the Brewers used to have a run prevention coordinator. I think they still do though. The guy that they had now is with the White Sox, Walker McKinven, but he'll be a manager soon, by the way. Walker McKinven is a name to keep an eye on for that, but they're just so good at bringing pitchers through and developing up from within. And that's a huge credit to Hook, who I think is kind of the CEO of that whole operation, but everybody else underneath as well, in terms of getting the most out of arms. And it goes all the way to the front office too, because they have to identify players that they can work with. Quinn Priester is a perfect example of this. Quinn Priester is having a breakout year for the Brewers after they traded for him at the very beginning of the season when things looked really bad for the Brewers, that everybody was hurt. They had a huge month about pitching injuries, and they brought in Quinn Priester, and everybody kind of said, we have a guy on our podcast who is a pitching coach, and he said, I don't see it with Priester. I don't see what the Brewers are seeing. And then all of a sudden, they have turned him into a much better pitcher. They've made tweaks to his arsenal. They have made him a better pitcher. And so that goes to credit not just Chris Hook, but like the entire staff was involved in making that kind of improvement. And it's, again, this is something they're just so good at and are kind of the envy of the game, I think, for most teams.
I think you're right. And I was trying to think of some of the other pitchers' names that suddenly escaping me. But I mean, I can remember interviews with some of them. Who is the elderly or old elderly pitcher that we got this year? Good grief.
Jose Quintana.
Quintana was talking about what they talked to him about when he got there, and they said, you know, and telling him what to zero in on. And he said it made a huge difference, Ryan. It did make a
huge difference. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It made a huge difference. And even a guy, a veteran who knows what he's doing, like Quintana, will still take things from the Brewers organization and be able to learn. But also the Brewers learn from him. They're very good at this. They did this with Wade Miley as well and countless other pitchers. They bring in these veteran pitchers because they love the influence that they can have on some of their younger pitchers in helping kind of be extra coaches. And people have cited Quintana as that. Freddie Peralta, who's been with the Brewers since he was, you know, just a kid himself, he has turned into sort of an elder statesman that way. I mentioned Wade Miley in the past, who has a future as a pitching coach. All of these types of guys, they're all part of this stew of smarts that the Brewers bring to the table.
And Peralta is now, I think, leading the league in wins. I think he's got 15 wins now. He certainly looked good yesterday. I had a little hiccup in one inning with the bases loaded and one out, I think.
Yeah, but that's really good to see from Peralta, too, and I think a testament to how much he has improved and become that veteran statesman on the Brewers. One of Freddie's problems in the past has been that he sometimes lets himself get blown up when things don't quite go his way, or he starts to nibble too much and be too careful. I actually viewed yesterday's game as kind of a test case for him because, you know, this is, they have a huge lead in the division right now. It's not the most pressure-filled Cubs series you could ever have, but you want to avoid a disaster in that. The Cubs lineup, for as big a lead as we have, the Cubs are still very good. They're debatably still the second best team in the National League. And it's a hard lineup to get through. And he was just masterful yesterday at giving them a start that they really did need after the bullpen was taxed in a few extra inning games in a row. So Freddie has definitely taken to like feedback, pitching lab influence, like everyone else has. He has improved every season over the past few seasons and become really a true frontline starter for this team.
I didn't want to, we've still got some time left, but I wanted to be sure to bring up the fact that the Brewers are ranked as having the best farm system in the game, I think, by Baseball America. So not only is the present looking very bright, but the future looks pretty bright as well. How did that happen, and who should we be looking forward to down the road for the Brewers?
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I was at the game last Wednesday with my folks, and our co-host, James, sent a message to the group saying, yeah, Baseball America just ranked us the number one farm system in baseball. They kind of laughing at me because I probably got more excited about that than just about anything. I do our minor league podcast as well. Yeah, the Brewers farm system is just continues to turn out talent, and MLB is set up to keep this from happening. Big part of what MLB does is they give you the worst records. The teams with the worst records get the high draft picks, and the high draft picks are especially important in baseball because those tend to be the superstar players. You can create good players later, but the very best players, it's usually pretty apparent, and those guys go early. So it's real hard for a team to be able to be consistently good and then picking at the bottom of the draft and sustain a top-level farm system. And a big part of why the Brewers have done that is they've been exceptional on the international market lately. Jackson Churio is obviously a young budding star for them right now. Freddie Peralta goes back, and he was actually a trade acquisition, but if you look at some of these young guys that are coming up, there's two names in particular really to know, their top two prospects, and that's Jesus Mate and Luis Peña, who are both shortstops, though they'll probably end up moving around a little bit. We'll see who could kind of stick at short. But these are two of the best hitting 18-year-olds in the game right now. They dominated in the Dominican Summer League last year and have come up and are the youngest players. They were so good in Carolina, where they were the youngest players in the Carolina League, that they got promoted up a level to Wisconsin, to the Timber Rattlers. And I'm actually going to get to go see them this Friday. I'm looking forward to that very much. And Jesus Mate is a special talent, really, really a special talent. The ball just jumps off his bat in a way that you don't see very often. So Jesus Mate is another player to get excited about for the Brewers for the future, in the vein of, he honestly was ahead of where Jackson Churio was at some of the same points.
Another email wondering about catcher Danny Jensen. I think we got from the Tampa Bay Rays last month. And this is an Appleton emailer. He's from Appleton. What do you think of him? What of his performance so far? He caught yesterday, I think.
Danny Jensen is a good player. He is. So Eric Haas was the incumbent backup catcher, a decent enough player, but it's good to have a solid veteran backstop behind William Contreras, just so you don't sacrifice huge amounts of offense when you have to give him a day off. One of the problems the Brewers have had is that, frankly, William Contreras loves playing. He does not like taking days off. And so it hasn't been a huge problem. Like, literally, he and Willie Adames last year basically insisted on playing every day. It's not good for him. And he's had actually a broken finger for most of the year. It's easier to make the case that he needs to take a break if you actually have a competent major leaguer behind him. No offense to Eric Haas, who did a fine job while he was here, but there's a long trail on Eric Haas' stats, and he's just barely a major league hitter. Danny Jensen is not. Danny Jensen is a pretty decent backup catcher, formerly a very, very good framer. One of the things the Brewers are very good at, in addition to pitching development, is training their catchers and retraining them to trick umpires into turning balls into strikes for them, called framing. It is a stat. It's something that doesn't always age particularly well. It's something that Jansen used to excel at and has fallen off a bit. I suspect they think they can get him back up to above average in that. And so he's been good, and it's just nice to have a good, solid depth catcher that they didn't really have before.
And it's nice to have you guys join in once in a while and talk about the Brewers. Thanks so much, Ryan Topp and Paul Noonan. They host, the title of the podcast is Milwaukee's Tailgate Brewers Podcast, and you can easily find it when you go online. Well, hopefully they'll come back and be with us again. And thank you for joining us today, full day. And, of course, thanks to Clara Neipert and Joel Patnaud, our technical directors Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robin, our executive producer Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.